Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Good afternoon. From Aspen Public Radio, I'm Allison Bektesh. This is Valley Roundup. On today's show, revelations about the Aspen School District HR director call into question the school system for background checks. Affordable housing could be coming to one of Aspen's last undeveloped plots, and the Valley will benefit from a statewide initiative for more green energy. Joining me today are Madeline Osberger, contributing editor with the Aspen Daily News. Madeline, so nice to have you here.
Great to be here.
Rick Carroll, managing editor with the Aspen Times. Hi, Rick.
Hello.
And Aspen Public Radio's Elizabeth Stewart. Every Elizabeth, thanks for being here.
You bet.
You are listening to Valley Roundup from Aspen Public Radio. All right, Rick, I want to start with your story about the Aspen School District. It's about HR Director Elizabeth Hodges, who was disbarred from practicing law in Missouri in the spring. And that's a whole case, but I think I want to start with how she got here. Can we go into how she got the job, what the system was with for her becoming the HR director?
Yes, she told me that she learned about the job, I believe, in 2015, around December, through friends and the website. She came out here and reached an agreement with the school district to do on-the-job training with the outgoing HR director at the time. And so she shadowed her for several months with the understanding that she would get the HR job. And she took that, I believe, in July of 2016.
Were there other candidates for the job as well?
There were.
Okay.
And it was an advertised job, so there were other candidates.
Mm-hmm. And then what did you hear from the hiring committee about background checks on hiring this position?
Well, the hiring committee more or less was John Malloy, and there were some committees or boards that reviewed her credentials and interviewed her. But John Malloy, who's the superintendent of the school district, Dr. John Malloy, and then Sheila Wills, who's the president of the school board, both told me that they did thorough background checks on her.
And they were surprised by this fact that she had this past legal dispute in Missouri.
Well, she wasn't disbarred until this past April.
Right.
And I believe they were notified around the same time that the Aspen Times was initially through a U.S. postal mail, anonymous, postmarked out of Missouri, that Ms. Hodges had been disbarred in April. And so that mail included a Missouri Supreme Court order of her disbarment. And then further independent research by the Times showed other things that popped up, including a grand jury indictment in February of 2016. Grand jury indictments aren't, I mean...
It sounds really intense.
F. Lee Bailey has said you can indict a ham sandwich, so let's understand that
okay.
First. But this did lead to her guilty plea that December to a misdemeanor, and it had to do with her selling a Kia and taking the money, which was from an estate of a couple that she represented in their estate planning. Now, she was served with the indictment on May 31st, 2016. So she had to answer these charges. She was aware of it. And then this was during that training period, so to speak. And it's my understanding she took the job in July. That's based on minutes from the school district. But I also have some questions out to Dr. Malloy and Sheila Wills about that.
Well, really popped into my head when I read the excellent reporting,
yeah.
Rick, by
Thank
the way,
mm-hmm.
Why didn't that show up, the grand jury indictment, show up on the background check?
Good question, Madeline. And you have to, the question is, when did they do the background check? And so we have, mm-hmm. What if they did a background check in, February or March, it wouldn't have showed up. And so.
And that was during the shadow period.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so the question becomes, even if this didn't come through on that background check, between that time that she was served with the indictment and the time that she stepped on full board, what was she required to tell the school, or is that an expectation from the school? But she didn't.
Right.
And then, aside from all that, just all this other stuff that's been percolating with these civil judgments and this barment, which all goes back to her estate planning for this couple in Kansas City. It's all tied together.
I wonder about it. It doesn't seem immediately obvious that an attorney would be a top candidate, would have all the qualifications of an HR director. I'm not sure that I know mm-hmm. what the connections are
yeah.
there.
Several people have said that. And we did get her resume, and it presented her. Her resume basically includes her legal work. The school district, and when I say the district, I'm referring to Dr. Malloy and Sheila Wills, is that what they told me was that they felt that she had enough experience in labor law and
working
with unions. Yes, at one time she worked as an HR director for a law firm in the Kansas City area, but that's why she was in law school, I think. So she had a little experience in that or some, you know, knowing her way around or handling labor disputes or unions.
So you have that question of, well, how did she get the job? But then you also have this question, well, now everyone has the letter, the story's out. Mm-hmm. Is it appropriate for her to keep a job as an HR director at a school district in Aspen when she's been disbarred as a lawyer in Missouri? Mm-hmm. And the headline was, yeah, let's keep her. Mm-hmm. Malloy and Wills are very much in support of her just carrying on.
Correct. They feel that she's been through enough as it is, and that her job as HR director has been just fine, and they don't have a problem with it. They're pleased with the job she's doing. So that's where it's at. There's going to be more to this coming down, though. One thing that hasn't been reported, but I think it's common knowledge in the community, if you're a parent or if you work for the school district or have friends there, is that a number of teachers and educators and staff are afraid to come out and speak about this, and they are upset. And there might be some people in Elizabeth Hodges' corner too, but talked to multiple people, dozens, who are really upset that this is happening. And I go to this person, they have access to my Social Security number, my medical records, everything. And to them, this is problematic. But who do you go to?
The HR director. Yeah.
Right. Where does this go? There was a board meeting Tuesday night, which I went to. None of this came up during public comment. You would have not have known this was going on during the meeting. Now, what happened during executive session when they closed the doors to the public? Who knows?
There was a comment on your the web version of this story from the public saying we should go to that meeting on Tuesday of this week. And then someone else pointed out, well, there it says directly, during school board meetings, we ask you to refrain from making complaints or negative comments regarding individual district employees.
Correct.
They have it as policy that you are not allowed to come to the school board and make a complaint.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I want to get into the comments a little bit more on that article, because it brings up this kind of philosophical question about ethics and journalism, which I'm excited to talk about with
sure.
the group in here, which is, you got this anonymous letter in the mail about the seedy backstory, to make it a little more sensational than
sure.
it is, of someone who lives and works in the Valley. Was that fair of you to put her dirty laundry on the front page?
Yes. I mean, and it's not just me saying this. We went over this with my publisher, my editor, other reporters. Initially, I was skeptical, or should I say, and I think you need to be skeptical
right.
about stories, especially when it, goes pretty deep on a subject matter like this, and there's a person involved who has a family. But we took several weeks. This was a slow roll, and some things surfaced during the reporting, which told us how can we not do this story? Was basically where we fell back on, and it was it boils down to a matter of trust with the school district and dirty laundry. You have to remember that. She gets $132,000 a year, oversees a staff of 250 to 265 people. This is a big position in the school district. You're an executive level here, and there's an expectation in this school district and others that your employees are honest and fair. And when you see something like this come up with the criminal guilty plea that she issued and everything else. I'm not being the judge, jury, and executioner right. here, but I think that the public needs to know about this, and they can decide. And if somebody wants to say it's unethical or you didn't have dirty laundry, that's fine. I mean, that's your opinion. I understand that. But where we're coming from, we felt that this is a trust issue that the public needs to know about.
And if, like you said, it is a guilty plea plus a disbarment. It's not an ongoing, like, we're not guessing how this is going to come out. These are the results of the court system in Missouri.
Correct.
I think you guys really played it like a big scoop, you know, a big headline mm-hmm. all the way across the top. So mm-hmm. I was a little taken aback when I first saw it. I thought, well, how can she get a fair shake here? But, you know, reading your extensive reporting, I get it. But I was taken aback when I first saw
sure.
it.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Because we didn't have the story, too.
Well. Should I put my address out? You want to put it out on the air? We'll yeah, take right. those letters as well.
I think the other thing, and I'm glad you clarified what the postmark was, because I wondered if it was a disgruntled Aspen parent who
now,
had sent that letter.
Only if they were in St. Louis at the time.
Right.
Elizabeth thinks it's vindictive heirs of the state who are trying to use the media to get this story out. I could see why she feels that way.
Sure. I think it just, to close this out, also begs the bigger question of what background checks or kind of what standard does the leadership at the Aspen School District, what are you required to meet? Because this is not the first time, right? Even Superintendent John Malloy gets hired, and then it's found out that he also left his last position in Indiana under a really unhappy school district, mm-hmm. and the school board has stood solidly behind him. So this mm-hmm. isn't the first executive who, if it had been during interview process, maybe they wouldn't have gotten that job, but if we find out after you get the job, you hold the job. And I think mm-hmm. that's one of the issues as well.
Yep.
Madeline, I want to talk about a story that you wrote this week about the Racquet Club. And you've kind of had the scoop on this one the whole time. But one of the last undeveloped parcels, and maybe we'll get affordable housing out of it.
Perhaps. The neighborhood, that East Aspen neighborhood, is near and dear to my heart. Little disclosure, I lived there for 21 years. We had our first condo there. We lived in Bill Dunaway's old cabin there. And it's just a wonderful part of town, but it's starting to change. But one of the things that has not changed in all these years since the early 70s is that Racquet Club. And that Smuggler Racquet Club is just, it's a piece of old Aspen, and its members are a piece of old Aspen. And it's been great to see that. So it's an awesome piece of property. You know, I've heard, I think the developable is about a little over 2 acres, and
okay.
the total parcel is 6 acres, but now I've heard only 4 of those acres could actually be used, hearing back and forth. but two developers were serious contenders, according to the reporting I've done. One was Sunrise, which kind of got eked out of a project in Snowmass. That's when I got mm-hmm. to know those developers, local, you know, Teddy Farrell, who grew up here, and Randall Bone, who has deep ties here. And they were going against Per Johansson. His wife, Margot, used to be on the school board a few years ago. He bought the Smuggler Mine a few years back. What Per wanted to do, apparently, according to his representative, Tim Mooney, was to employ housing component up in the mine area and then buy this 2-acre parcel and put some high-end homes and condos. That was Per. So Sunrise wants to do the entire development on the parcel. So there was a vote 2 weeks ago, and this is where I'm going to do, just like you, Rick, I'm going to do some follow-up reporting. They had a meeting, and then some new board members were elected. And then after that, the members were kind of surprised. They were given a question. Okay, would you like to see development on this parcel? Because that could provide money for new tennis courts, et cetera. And the members voted, and it wasn't a huge majority. Not all of them were there. Okay, they said yeah. But then they were given a second question, a follow-up, and people said they felt, in subsequent reporting, they felt ambushed by this. Do you want Sunrise or do you want Per Johansson? Well, Sunrise won out, but then the members felt like suddenly this steamroll, it was just moving into this, and they perhaps weren't ready for that. So I think that the members have approached me and said that they will get the final say if they want that. There's also this little uprising now. Some people are saying, well, we've got enough to go. We have enough capital reserves. We can go 7 years. And if we do a special assessment for about $800 each, we can go 12 years. So why do we need to sell this right now? A lot of the members are, you know, not spring chicken. And maybe by this time this is all completed, they won't be there to play tennis. So that's kind of where we are. They had a vote. Sunrise got a letter of agreement. Some of the members are quite unhappy. Others are like, well, maybe we'll finally get a pickleball court.
the developer would get the land. I mean, this is the Racquet Club giving up something that they've held on to for so long that is very sought after in Aspen, which is undeveloped land within city limits. The developer would pay $15.5 million. They would make, in either case, a combination of free market homes and affordable housing, and then they would recoup all that, all the revenue from those operations.
Someone mentioned to me 2 days ago that one monster home in that area could be worth $15 million right there. You could make that money back. So, and that's why I think some of the members are getting a little cold feet now, like, hey, why sell now?
I thought it was fascinating that the Smuggler Mine is developable. I didn't know that was one of the places we could start looking at for affordable housing. That's a big deal.
I think when Pear bought that a few years ago, that he wasn't just buying a mine.
Okay.
Just thought, you know, mines are cool, but...
We know from your reporting that the members maybe chose one of two options, but no contracts have been signed yet. This isn't...
There's a letter of agreement,
okay,
which whether that's a contract or not, I don't know. I'm not an attorney, so it's... But that is, you know, it's the largest open track in Aspen that we see right now. I mean, maybe the Meadows is larger, but we're not going to see much development out there.
But, and so credit that anyone is discussing that affordable housing be built on that if they can just build a couple condos and make, you know, way more money, obviously. So
but the other thing is it's only zoned right now for a single family home. So this is all reliant, upon the city council would have to change planning and zoning or whoever does that. So city would... Yes. So stay tuned.
Yeah, exactly.
More stories to come from this.
You are listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Putting the news of the week into perspective for us today are Madeline Osberger. She's a contributing editor with the Aspen Daily News. Rick Carroll, managing editor with the Aspen Times, and Aspen Public Radio's Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. We'll be right back. Elizabeth, I want to come to you now with a story that is statewide with local implications and, of course, right up your area of expertise, that Colorado may, within the next 5-10 years, become 55%
renewable energy. Yeah. Xcel Energy has a plan to close 2 of 3 coal-fired power plants in Pueblo. It's the Comanche Generating Station. Those two that they're going to close are older and dirtier plants than the one that's going to stay open is newer and, you know, cleaner coal. And it does mean that the state of Colorado, Xcel is a huge provider in the state, and the projections are that it could be 55% renewable energy by 2026. So it'll be a pretty big leap.
We heard from your reporting this week that this is super significant, not just in the state, but maybe the country, the world. Why is that?
Well, Auden Schendler, who's SKECO's vice president of sustainability, kind of made that case, saying because so little action is happening on the national level, that it really is up to states to step up. His point is that this is coming from a business and not from environmental groups, that it's not being led by the state or by politicians or by environmentalists, but it's actually a move that's coming from the business community saying that actually this is going to be better for our bottom line in the long run as well as for the environment.
So it's a signifier that it might not matter what gets tied up in federal state regulations about how clean our energy is. It might just come down to green dollar bills.
Right, exactly. a different kind of green. Yeah. And that, you know, it is becoming with even without the same kinds of national federal incentives for moving towards renewables. They are becoming more cost effective. And Brian Hannigan, who's the CEO of Holy Cross Energy, which provides most of the electricity in the Roaring Fork Valley, Xcel provides to some customers in Glenwood Springs and Carbondale. But for most of us, it's Holy Cross. And he talked about how Holy Cross is looking into renewables as well. And they're going to get some of that from Xcel. But his point is kind of the same, that, yeah, we're concerned about the environment, but also we have a responsibility to our customers to keep things affordable, and it is becoming more and more affordable to go greener.
All right, wonderful. Elizabeth, you attended a meeting this week, which was the second of 2 official meetings put on by the Colorado Parks and Wildlife to talk about the Basalt Gun Range. I know, Rick, you've been at one earlier that even gubernatorial candidate Jared Polis was at. And I just kind of want to check back in with what we think is going to happen with the Basalt Gun Range, especially, Elizabeth, from being in the room. What is there anything we're still not talking about? Are there issues that are kind of percolating that's not front and center right now about this gun range?
You know, it's such a heated debate. And it feels so personal on so many levels for so many people. So I think a lot of people in Basalt who were immediately impacted by the Lake Christine fire for a very long period of time feel like, yeah, we understand that we need a safe place for people to go shoot, but maybe this isn't the best place for it. It's a hard conversation to have, and it's under pressure because hunting season is coming up so quickly. Colorado Parks and Wildlife officials, they know that there's a push for getting the range opened in time for people to have a place to sight rifles. Perry Will, who works for CPW, brought up the fact that you can shoot on public lands. It's not illegal to discharge a firearm on Forest Service or BLM lands. And he brought it up in a way that sort of sounded like, hey, you know, like we've got this like leverage kind of that people could just be going anywhere and shooting their guns. And he read a comment from somebody that somebody sent in a comment saying, isn't it legal for me to just go shoot my gun near Maroon Lake? And it just feels a little bit incendiary, you know, like
a threat.
Yeah. A little bit like if we don't get this gun range back open, we could cause some real havoc. And I'm not at all saying that the dominant message, but I do think there's an undercurrent that it's tough to pin down.
Rick, was it, do you think a, like going out on a limb for Jared Polis to say that he backs this gun range where a fire started that just threatened that entire town?
I don't know. These gubernatorial candidates making these, you know, whistle stop.
Helicoptering in.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe that comment, he might not be as plugged in as he should be on the matter, or maybe that's his true feelings.
Yeah.
But yeah, that didn't resonate with everybody, did it?
And you have both, Madeline and Elizabeth, reported on some, the fire's not completely contained yet. We have some updated numbers on how it's affected the environment. We have like a mop-up crew, as it's called, still there. Any other comments on this still ongoing fire in Basalt?
It's going to be a lot of years of impacts from this fire. We know that from like the flash flood warnings that have been going out.
Every time we have a big storm, I'm sure there's concern, like over
and
the
fear,
weekend.
Yeah.
Fear. Yeah, of mud coming, squishing down.
And, so I think it's a tricky thing because you're hoping for rain, obviously, in this. And there's, I think there are a lot of emotions tied up in it. And I think people who live really close to the gun range are going to continue to see those impacts more than a lot of other people. I mean, downtown Basalt is in the floodplain, a lot of it. So it does seem like there is an area in our valley that's been certainly most impacted by the fire, and it's not going away really anytime soon. So I think a long-term discussion is helpful, and that's kind of what Basalt Town Council was pushing for. CPW is not entirely excited about the fact that Basalt Town Council kind of issued a resolution ahead of the final meeting from CPW. Their officials talked about how like they didn't really feel that was appropriate. Mm-hmm. They wanted to wait to get all the public feedback. They felt that Basalt Town Council should have waited until that second mm-hmm. public meeting before they said, here are our recommendations. I think it is worth noting that Basalt Town Council is representing and responsible to a different group of people than CPW is.
Certainly.
There were a lot of people from up and down the valley who use the Basalt gun range, but they aren't Basalt residents. And they had sign-in sheets.
With like where you're from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, interesting.
And people were coming from across the valley, from as far as Rifle and Aspen on the other end. And I think Basalt Town Council is beholden to the people who are living in Basalt,
sure. Yeah.
who see different impacts than the people who use this gun range as an amenity for hunting and other things.
Well, as a citizen, I think I want to close on thanking, just being so grateful that there's journalists in the world who will sit through an entire Aspen City Council meeting about the public being upset about alternative transportation. Rick and Elizabeth, thank you so much for keeping us up on the Shift Mobility Lab. Rick, your headline is that Shift has hit some bumps in the road, which is very clever because it is about these other ways that we can get to, around, through Aspen, instead of just one person in one car parking all day. So what are those bumps?
First off, the only reason I was at that meeting is because the City Hall reporter was in Minnesota. But it brought back such wonderful meetings of my time spent down there in the basement of City Hall. What was your question?
So obviously, it's multifaceted. Let's think of ways we could do ride shares. Let's think of incentives for getting people to park in a garage and not on the street. All these, how can we get more people on bikes? So it sounds like it's totally in line with what Aspen would want to be, a greener, mm-hmm. less vehicle-based city. Mm-hmm. Why are people mad about that?
You know, there's this undercurrent in town of, you know, the private businesses. Todd Gardner was representing, he owns High Mountain Taxi, and he's pretty upset that with what he feels is that the city just keeps, you know, it's kind of drip, you know, with expanding the territory of the downtown, or now they wanted to do more expanded service out towards Buttermilk, I think, or the Intercept lot, and then on-demand service. And then you've also, there weren't any bike shop owners there, but they also feel like, you know, this WeCycle is cutting into our revenue. And so and I think Adam Frisch, I won't say he hijacked the meeting, but I will say he hijacked the meeting. He did hijack the meeting. Maybe that was his, but Adam made some good points too. And then there's also this part about, I think some people just feel like, God, this is so damn confusing. Like, okay, I get this mileage app and I have to do all this. And I think the city comes from a good place on this. And they recognize there's a problem here. How can you not? But now they're trying to change behaviors. And whenever you try to do that with people who are set on their ways, especially in this town, you know, there's going to be blowback. And so
maybe the downtowner should be extended to Red Mountain. That's where a lot of the traffic seems to be.
Yeah. That.
That's where I think a lot of the impacts come from. That's a big hill. So.
I saw them going quite far up the pass on a hike yesterday, and that's not in their district. So someone's getting an extra tip to go a little further. Elizabeth, what else did we learn in that meeting?
Well, I was just going to build off of something Rick said. It is a multifaceted project. There are a lot of moving parts, and I think because of that,
no pun intended.
There are, right, or stalled parts.
Yeah.
Stalled parts.
Yield.
But I think because of that, there are a lot of questions that council is trying to wrap its head around. And I think it could be a preview of the way the community is going to try to wrap its head around all these different pieces. There are kind of, I think maybe you could break it into three different projects. There's some improvements in amenities they want to put at the Intercept lot to encourage people to get out of their cars at the Intercept lot and get on a bus and get a coffee maybe on the way.
Yeah.
There's talk of improvements to Buttermilk and maybe doing like cargo bikes from Buttermilk. So you could put your dog in the bike and ride into town and then bring your dog and some groceries back to your car at Buttermilk. And then this expanded ride service, that is talking about going to Cemetery Lane, Red Mountain, and some of those other kind of hotspots where people are now driving into town. It's too far to walk. And I think that staff has a really big challenge of conveying everything that they've researched over the past year to council in a 3-hour work session. They've been pretty infrequent sessions and check-ins, and the process has been long and complicated, and I'm sure pretty boring at times. And then I think it also boils down to the fact that this is an experiment. It's a 3-month experimental project. So when we do all this work and spend all this money, and people might like some things and they don't like other things, and that's the point, is to figure out what could work. And then at the end, how do we know what we're going to fund and how we're going to fund it and where that money is going to come from, I think is sort of a ghost hanging over the whole project,
and
too.
Probably, I mean, from taxpayer dollars, you know, via the general fund or something like that. Mm-hmm. So there is that element of, you better have checked in with the citizens at some point, because, you know, it's my money that's going to WeCycle. It's my money that's going to the downtowner, whether I use it or not.
Right.
You've been listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Thanks so much for the journalist putting the news of the week in perspective for us. Madeline Osberger, contributing editor with the Aspen Daily News. Rick Carroll, managing editor with the Aspen Times. And Aspen Public Radio's Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. Thank you all for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.